Okay, so everybody at this point has handed in their term? Well, it's two minutes ago, so you're done talking. I care a lot, but your job was to get it done when it's due, hand it in. You have 5 days. Now is not the time to copy. Is there anybody who's in a situation that you have only emailed it to me and not provided paper copy? Fine. Just a reminder that if you transcribe, I still need to see the original. And hopefully I won't look at it. It's just if there's some confusion, I want to be able to go back to the work. More precisely, I want Swaroop to be able to go back to the work. Because if all you have is answers, it's difficult to give partial credit. Now means now. Okay? The grade's dropping fast. Thank you. Greg, in the future, it's staple with people. I understand it.
Yeah.
For your sake. I'm sure it would have been long for supper. I have the stapler downstairs that occasionally works. I'm interested in your thoughts on the midterm. First, was it in fact, in hindsight, was this a reasonable way to go? Maybe feel that this was problematic. It's the first time I've run a midterm this way, so I'm actually interested in feedback.
I think it's better than being crammed in.
Better than being crammed in, at least one person. Of course, the flip side of this is if you really didn't do the reading, you might have said, oh no, now I gotta do the whole half semester! For which you should understand I have exactly zero sympathy, but it's possible that you felt that way. I'll, you know, you're welcome to cry over here, but, okay. One concern that was raised, because I mentioned to one of the other faculty members who, in light of what I'm going to tell you, I won't name, that I was planning to do this way is, and the faculty member said, well, it's all cheap. To which I replied, well, but I don't care. Which isn't quite true. I mean, I do care. There's an integrity issue, and integrity is important. The reason I was willing to take that chance, I'll tell you a story. A few years ago, I think maybe 3 or 4 years ago now, there was a belief circulating on campus that there was universal cheating. And numbers were collected or alleged to have been collected that something very disturbing, like 2/3 of the student population acknowledged having cheated in some form at some point. Maybe I should be careful, because I don't remember if it was 2/3 or 1/3, but I remember it was some very depressingly large number. And in honor of this discovery that year, I decided to run an experiment in my class, and I wrote 2 midterms, having the property that the questions looked very much alike if you looked over at your neighbor, but they were just different enough that if you copied your neighbor's answer, you were seriously out of luck. I figured that we'd end up catching something. Frankly, I hoped that we didn't. It wasn't that I thought people in my class were cheating. It's that having listened a little bit to what information people had gotten about who they thought was cheating had gone to me, that nobody had actually done any controlled experiments. Right. And so I decided to do one. And the answer is nobody in this class cheated. At least not on that midterm. And I didn't tell them until after the midterm was over. And when I say the problems were very similar, I mean, like, there was a problem on walking a virtual address space, but the address you had to deal with differed in 2 digits. And 2 digits that turned out to matter in the answer. So they were really close. And if you were sort of looking casually, you could very easily not realize you had a different paper. And I arranged that no 2 papers that were the same were adjacent. Yeah.
Same class?
This was an in-class midterm. Yeah. Yes. So first, there's a piece of good news, right? Whatever you may have heard, At least in this class, and I suspect in most of our upper level classes, it does not appear to be the case that students are actually cheating. And I've had that confirmed from other faculty who've done various other kinds of tests. Second, if you've gotten to thinking about it, you should realize that the rumor about cheating is much higher than the actuality. But third is, when I think about the kinds of things that I've heard about when I've asked other people, so what's actually going on? There are places where what's going on is something I would consider cheating, and there are other places where what's going on is something that I think is, it's cheating in a technical sense, but it's a borderline behavior that in my class I would actually prefer to encourage. So, at least in computer science, we do see cases where people who are supposed to be working independently consult on programs that they're building or something, or they go to the web and look something up, and up to a point that's perfectly reasonable. The problem is it's very easy to step across the line, even without realizing that you're doing it. And I think there's a certain sort of natural border case kind of issue that arises there, and I think that you can't say to people don't help each other. Part of the cost of saying, yeah, you've got to talk to each other is occasionally people are going to step over the line at the margin. What we need to do is awareness. I do think occasionally people go too far there. I also think that when things are unsupervised, you know, people cut corners when they're desperate. But particularly on homeworks. I have to say that I am of mixed feelings about homeworks. Part of the purpose of homeworks is to evaluate, and to the extent that you're trying to evaluate, you need them done by the person you think did them. Right? But the other part of them is to learn, and often the most effective way to learn is to work with somebody else. And so there's sort of an interesting catch-22 there. And the problem is that I have, at upper levels it's better, but I've observed that many Hopkins students, and this may or may not apply to you, but if the shoe fits, wear it. Many Hopkins students are extremely busy. They think, for whatever reason, and sometimes they are, they think they're under extreme pressure, and so they optimize for this week. And that's understandable, you know, when you're sitting under four or five assignments, right? Yes, you'll have to manage a bigger workload later in the real world, but okay. If you're sitting under four or five assignments, it's easy to say, hey, I gotta get this done tomorrow, and I'll deal with it next week. Of course, I'll deal with it, it never comes, because next week is just as bad. So the problem with the homework story is what happens is two people work together. Sometimes what will happen is one of them will be weaker, the weaker person will get carried by the stronger person, and instead of it being an exchange in which the weaker person learns, and not weaker person, but weaker in that area. Instead of being an exchange where the person who's weak in the area learns, right, it becomes an exchange where the person who's weak in the area sponges. And then it backfires, because then when they get into a midterm or an exam, it shows up, and it shows up in a really, really painful way. And the sad part about that is, for those students, if I'd said to them, do the homework yourself, they might not have done it, but they would have dropped. And they would have gotten clobbered at the midterm or the final. It's an interesting problem to know what to do as a teacher, and there doesn't seem to be a perfect answer, I guess is what I'm saying. But the main message I wanted to give you is the rumors of cheating at Hopkins are exaggerated. And they're undermining the community. And that's unfortunate. All right, end of soliloquy. Let me go back to file systems. Oh, questions on the midterm?
Can you go up the buddy system / virtual memory version? Number 10.
Yeah. I can try. We'll find out if I can go over it. Okay. So we've got an initial memory block of 128K. And the buddy system will split down to some minimal size. It's defined, right? In this case, 4K. And there's a sequence of allocations, and the question asks, so what does it look like when this sequence is?
I was asking on the one where you don't need the buddy system.
I'll do that as well.
Sorry.
Okay. So the first request is 4K. So you got to split to 64, split to 32, split to 16, split to 8, split to 4, which is a good illustration of why we need a bigger blackboard. 4, 8, 16 block. So you'll get your 12 there with a waste of 4 because it won't allocate down to a 12 block since it's not a power of 2. You'll get a 4 here. This is your 32 block. And it turns out this is an 8 block. So that's what you'll come out of, assuming I got it right on the board. Well, I told you my story about John Hennessy. John Hennessy is now the president of Stanford. He's a very famous processor architect and a very, very talented, smart guy. He can't work problems at a blackboard to save his life. Okay? And so one of the sources of entertainment in his architecture class, and I should just point out, John's wonderful. I'm one of the people who reviewed the early drafts of these books, and I get along very, very well. But, you know, in any class, right, there's the people at the bottom who are struggling. There's this big gap in the middle, right, the people who are kind of with you. And then there's the people at the top who are kind of, you know, they're there because occasionally there's something at the base of the board, right? None of you, of course, but. So those people look for a way to entertain themselves. And so in that particular class, our way of entertaining ourselves was to predict which way John would get the problem wrong this time and help him sort himself out at the blackboard. So as far as I remember, I took two or three classes with John. I do not remember him ever solving a problem at the blackboard correctly the first time. So if you struggled with an intern, right, remember, the guy's now president of Stanford, right? It can't be that important. Anyway, virtual memory. So yeah. Notice, this was an awkward question and required you to pull together a bunch of things we've talked about that I've never explicitly connected the dots on. Suppose instead that we started with a page memory. Right? And that page memory consists of a whole bunch of 4K blocks, because 4K is sort of the most common page size. The problem that the buddy system is trying to solve for us is physical memory fragmentation. But notice the least unit that it's going to allocate is a page. Okay. So now consider the possibility that I need 3 pages, but the ones that are free are these ones that I've marked for the next. So I need a total of 12K. But I don't have it contiguous in the physical memory. Thing is, when I have a virtual memory system, I don't need the physical pages to be contiguous. What I need is a contiguous chunk of the virtual address space. And then I can map to these pages wherever they are. So because of that, in a system where what I'm mapping is pages, and I have a virtual translation unit, I can't have fragmentation at the physical layer, because everything is effectively relocatable. So that was the intended answer to the question. But let me point out that there's a catch. And this is one of those questions where you either saw the catch and answered about that and said, no, this question is just wrong, or you didn't and you gave the answer I just gave. So here's the catch. So when you pick up a problem, okay, you pick it up, you stare at it for a while, and you say, oh, I can solve this problem by moving it over there. When you step over there, you discover, oh, but now I have the same problem over here. You haven't solved the problem. So the problem with moving this into the virtual address space is now the problem is reduced from fragmentation at the physical layer, which was the original problem we were trying to solve. Now we have to deal with fragmentation at the virtual layer. We have to find 12K of contiguous virtual addresses. In this case, moving the problem in that particular way actually helps. And the reason is, there are two reasons for this. The first is, generally speaking, and there are now some exceptional cases, but generally speaking, the available virtual space is much larger than the available physical space. And so you have more ability to tolerate fragmentation or inefficient allocation in the virtual space, right? Suppose I said, I'm always going to allocate virtual space in units of 64K. You only need 4K? Too bad. I'm going to use 64K of virtual address space, and the last 60K are going to be unmapped. Not mapped at all. Invalid. Well, I got a lot of 64K units in my virtual address space. I don't have so many in my physical address space. Until very, very recently, that's flipped. Very recently. There's a second factor, which is actually more, and those 60, they're not costing me anything. I had to allocate that page table anyway. One way or another, those page table entries are going to be there. I had to set the invalid bits on them anyway. So not costing me very much. There is some cost because now I'm going to need more page tables because I'm allocating a bigger chunks, but that's log base 1024 of the number of allocations I did. That's a very small factor. Second factor that's actually more important than that one. If I satisfy an allocation by building a virtual mapping, notice that the physical map is a global namespace. The namespace of physical pages is universally shared. If I allocate a physical page, you can't have it. Now, I here means the kernel operating on behalf of me versus the kernel operating on behalf of you. Right? In a properly designed system, we're not going to tell you anything about physical page addresses. There's some caveats to that coming later in the course. But fragmentation at the physical level is a universally shared fragmentation. Right? Everybody gets hit. So that's a global namespace. The virtual map, this is not generally true in a kernel, but at the application level, the virtual map is a local namespace. Every application has its own virtual map. Now, that does not wave a magic wand and let me avoid the fragmentation problem entirely. I can still get fragmentation. But here's what I do get. If I'm managing fragmentation with the physical map layer, I have to consider all the possible requests that I might get. And those requests are going to be interleaved for multiple applications. So it's not, there's no opportunity to plan. If I'm managing a local map, look, in abstract, I can, in principle, know what kinds of allocations my application does. And if I know that, I can choose an allocator that's well suited to my allocations, and I can exploit application-specific knowledge to reduce fragmentation. Right? Remember that the buddy system story says, this is the best you can do given a stream of random allocations. My comment at the time was, how many random allocation patterns have you seen in the world? The answer is none. So, by moving the allocation problem from a global namespace to a local namespace, you change qualitatively the problem you're trying to solve by eliminating interference, or at least reducing it. So this is a case where pushing the problem from one layer of abstraction to another actually alters the problem in some important way. Does that answer your questions? Other questions from the intern?
What's the only way to make a machine running Windows secure?
Turn it off. Unplug it. In principle, it's not possible to secure Windows. I don't think it's hard. I mean, it cannot mathematically be done.
Are the solutions in the building?
Yes, I will make them available. I may have to write them down first.
What's the mathematical model for calculating secureness of the
node? That has a long answer and a short answer. The short answer is in 74, but don't hold me to that. Two papers were published. The first was a paper by Harrison, Rizzo, and Alma. The paper explores something called the safety problem, and I'm anticipating a lecture yet to come on access control and protection. The safety problem says, if I have a system, and I have a bunch of what are called subjects, give us say processes, and I have a bunch of objects, and I have some access rights on these objects, read, write, things like that. I have an initial configuration of the system, and I have a set of operations that can be done, and the effect of these operations is to move permissions around the system, and add them, take them out. The safety question is, for an arbitrary initial configuration of the system, or even for a given one, what I would like to know is, can this particular access right on this particular object, pick one of each, can that be obtained by this here subject for some particular subject? So really what I'm trying to determine is the negative, and I want the answer to be no, because what I'm trying to establish is that process can't get access to this object. That's the reason I'm asking this question. This is called the safety problem. And the question that the Harrison, Rizzo, and Alma paper asks is this problem decidable? And the answer in the general case is no. And they looked at a variety of different protection systems, including all of the ones that are in commodity use today, and for every last one of them, the answers are quite bad. In most cases, the answer is no. It's not decidable. There are a few for which the answer is yes, it's decidable, and the access can get there. Those are called broken. Okay. In the same year, there's a paper published by Larry Snyder and Amiga Jones showing that if you ask that same question for capability-based systems, not only is it decidable, but it's decidable in linear time in the size of the object is. And this is a complicated answer for why do I work on capability systems. In principle, we might know how to secure them if we're careful not to implement them. Linux can't be fixed. But there's more. The Harrison, Rizzo, and Alma paper, which everybody abbreviates HRU because that gets kind of painful to say after a while. The HRU paper is asking, is the problem decidable in general? Now, in hindsight, I talked to Jeff Allman about this. In hindsight, Jeff is actually a little embarrassed about the paper because he thinks it emphasized the wrong outcome looking backwards. Right? You know, the big push on the paper was the problem is undecidable in the general case. Now, problems that are undecidable in the general case are very often decidable in specific cases, and it often turns out those specific cases are the ones we actually care about in the real world. So the paper does more, much more, than the general undecidability result. First, it checks a bunch of access control systems, all with depressing outcomes. Second, it says, are there some general criteria, characteristics of an access model where if the access model has this characteristic, you're already dead? The answer is yes, there are. And it's depressing how easy it is to take a simple access model and make one addition to it to make it undecidable. One of the ways you can do it is to have compound preconditions. Right? You say something like, if this or that, then this thing is okay, you're gone. But it gets even worse. So the paper also says, but if the system you're analyzing is a finite graph, then the problem is always decidable. Now, I have yet to actually receive an infinite capacity computer. You know, if you get one of these, let me know, because I really like to see it. Well, all the machines I've ever worked on consist of finite object graphs. You may add this to them, right? But that's still a finite amount of storage. So, the right question asked, and the important result out of this paper is, well, what about the ones that are decidable in these finite cases, which are the ones we actually work on in the real world? The answer is, in every one of those cases, safety is decidable, and the answer is not safe for current commodity access control systems. Now, the Jones and Snyder and later Matt Bishop paper in Lipton, down there somewhere, says it's decidable, but that doesn't tell us whether it's safe. And sorry that you walked into this. Sam Weber, and there was a long debate in the literature saying in practice capability systems were unsafe, and there were some very ad hoc arguments given for why that had to be the case that turned out to have all been wrong. And almost all trivially wrong, embarrassingly wrong, obviously. And so in 2000, Sam Weber, actually in 99, finished a verification proof that we were able to enforce the confinement policy with the capability system. Confinement basically says, I have a program, inward communication is permitted, outward communication is not. If you can do confinement, you can do any higher level security policy that is in principle enforceable. Now, lots of things people want to do are not in principle enforceable, but that's the cornerstone thing you need to get from no policy to the atomic building block of policy, and then on that you can build a policy. Finally, it's the atomic building block. So we actually finished a verification proof in 99, which was published in 2000, conclusively showing that all protective capability systems could, in fact, enforce confinement. And in the course of that, we basically rendered a large number of prior doctoral dissertations unnecessary in hindsight. Work that was done because people thought this couldn't be done. And it turns out it's actually straightforward. Yeah.
You're saying you can design, it's possible to design a system like where even they can't detect the number of allocated stages, and you've talked about before, where you could allocate virtual memory, and that would be a way of communicating information to other processes.
That's covert channels. It's not the allocation that I can detect, it's the latency of paging behavior. That's a covert channel question, and the question of the questions posed by Harrison, Rizzo, and Allman concerns overt security. Now, the reason this is important is, look, if I can't stop overt leakage, why in hell would you build a covert channel toolkit? Just send me the data. So we know that in capability systems we can do the overt problem. We know that within some limits we actually can limit the bandwidth of the covert channel. Nobody knows how to close covert channels completely in principle. However, we do know how to completely close covert channels where what we're talking about is the transmission of access rights in the system. And what that tells us is if we can limit the bandwidth of covert channels, we're down to only considering data. Now, if the question that the attacker is trying to exfiltrate from the machine is a yes or no question, like, given a large database of medical information, does a particular person suffer from HIV? Right. All I got to leak a single bit to do that. We don't know any technology that can avoid it. But if we're talking about exfiltrating any large amount of data, we actually do know how to put some effective limits on that. And pragmatically, of greater importance, the kinds of design discipline that you do when you deal with covert channel issues, contrary to popular myth, actually improve the performance of your system. So there are good reasons to do it even if you don't care about the covert channel issue per se. And just a hint for why. Reducing covert channels is largely done by being much more precise about your resource management. More precise means less waste means more done. So, longer story. But the fact is that very few people in the security community worry about covert channels at this point, because even when they are bandwidth limited, the bandwidth is still high enough that they're just impossible. And ultimately, the right solution to that problem. I mean, people deal with it in communication pipes, right? So secure embassy communications, when they're not actually transmitting data, they're transmitting white noise. They just never turn off the transmitter. Right? And that's because otherwise from the outside, even if I can't read the messages, hey, I noticed something happened in Washington and 50 embassies are now transmitting like that. Something's going on. And I probably know what, because I probably have advanced information about the threat environment within which the embassies are interacting. Right? Usually I know something's coming down, and what I now need to know is when and who's involved. Right? And I can do that by watching where the messages go, if there's unusual message traffic. So the solution to that, well, don't have any unusual message traffic. That's how the problem is actually solved. In computational systems, the answer is keep them isolated. Don't connect them to external networks. If the data is important enough that you really care about a covert channel problem, that's the only way to solve it. There is a second answer. Don't put on the computer anything that's going to transmit outwards. Now, that one's actually quite hard. But people have been surprisingly successful at it. It's actually hard to hide a covert transmitter. And in order for a covert channel to be useful, I have to have two programs on the machine. One on the inside that's in a position to get the data I'm trying to exfiltrate, and one on the outside of the security matter that catches it and retransmits it to the outside world. Because covert channels don't tend to go outside the machine matter. So that was a longer digression than we had time for, but I hope that answers your question. All right. I want to go back to file systems. Keep coming back to file systems. Last time I identified that there is a placement issue. Now, I pointed out that the placement issue can be mitigated by delaying writing down the metadata. The reason that's okay is, hey, if I crash, the file's not coming back anymore. And for writing one file, I mean, there's sort of two extremes, and then there's this ugly space in the middle. At one extreme, you have, look, system's only writing one file. Who gives a damn how many seeks I have to do? Nobody else cares. I'm only dealing with the one file. Nobody's waiting. If nobody's waiting, it doesn't matter how inefficiently you do it. At the other extreme, I've got 40 files in the memory cache. They're all making their way out to disk at the same time because I'm doing the 30-second sync. I've got a huge block of I/O to do. I'm going to sort this stuff. I'm going to move this whole block of I/O out at one time, okay? And nobody's waiting on that either, because unless they explicitly said to synchronize those files to the disk, I was done when I got it to the buffer cache. I haven't told you about the buffer cache. And there again, you know, I've already accepted a potentially 30-second delay. An extra 60 milliseconds to do another pass to write the metadata down is not such a big deal. And if I take the extra pass, I can block sort the metadata, and I can do that for all the files collectively in a subsequent pass, and I can amortize the I/O that way. There are lots of ways to amortize I/O. The point is, what I'm trying to amortize is the head motion, and if I have a lot of data to work with simultaneously, that becomes easy to do. So the very curious thing here is that in the memory allocation story, the problem was I was getting interleaved requests from different partners. In the disk I/O story, that's actually a benefit because it allows me to amortize the head motion better. Well, it's a benefit and a cost. It allows me to amortize the head motion better in the sense that I get more throughput to happen on any given pass ahead. But if you're actually waiting, that can create latency issues where your latency becomes unpredictable. The middle position is the ugly one. It's the one where you have reads and writes going on, you have five files in play, and you actually don't have enough going on to effectively amortize the head motion. That's actually why systems have a buffer cache. So what is the buffer cache? When you say write in a Unix system, that data does not go to the disk. It goes to an in-memory cache. And the system makes a note that this data has to get brought back to the disk, and it doesn't actually do that until a later time. And in Linux, the later time is determined by a program called BDFlush, which stands for Block Device Flush. BDFlush's sole purpose in life is to sleep for 30 seconds and kick the kernel in the butt and say, time to write the cache game. And the hope is that over a 30-second window, we're going to accumulate enough I.O. to amortize that arm motion effectively. Exercise. Recommend you do this. Only take you a few minutes. Go online. Pull Google up. Hunt down a web page that tells you how to configure Linux on a laptop to reduce power consumption. Look at the list of things they tell you to do. Very high up on that list, you will find reconfigure BDFlush to flush every 10 minutes. Why? Well, two reasons. One, hey, a modern laptop has a hell of a lot more memory than you can probably use. And if the cache becomes full, the kernel will flush it without being kicked in the butt. The reason BDFlush exists is to set an upper bound on how long the delay will be. Fine. In a laptop, you know what? If I'm losing power, I get a 3-minute warning. I've got plenty of time to do a desperation flush. So why do I want to increase this time? Because on a modern laptop, it turns out the most power-hungry device in the machine is not the processor. It used to be the display, but that's now close number two. Number one is the disk drive. The reason number one is the disk drive is you have to spin that damn thing up to 4,800 or 5,400 RPM. That is an enormous amount of kinetic energy, and it won't give it back when you slow it down. Those ERMs are lost. What you'd really like in a laptop drive, if you're going to spin it up and down, right, you'd like it spin down to turn the motor into a generator and drive that power back into the battery. Guess what? It ain't there. It'd be really easy to do, too. It's kind of a lovely laptop. Well, your next best choice is do not spin that puppy up. Get your state of memory and keep it that way. Let the drive actually spin down, because by the way, maintaining it at speed takes power too, and it's got resistance. Got a great story about that. Maybe for tomorrow. Spin it up, get your data off of it, spin it down, and leave it that way. And every 10 minutes, spin it up, write down your data, spin it down. You want to save power on a laptop? Don't run the drive. I can't do much about the backlight on the LCD, right? I can get you to turn it down, but at some point you can't read anymore and the laptop ceases to have much value. The disk is not adding value. Now, the buffer cache is the second one, which is, when I do a read, the way this works is, I go to the file system and I say, I want this range of the file. The file system figures out what are the contained blocks. It turns to the block layer system, which is a disk level subsystem, actually the buffer cache manages blocks, and says, I need the following blocks from the following devices. The ones that are not in the cache, get them. Wake me up when they're all back. Meanwhile, it sticks you on a queue, and it'll get back to you when your I.O. is satisfied. So, and similarly, when you go to flush, when you do fsync or sync or something like that, what happens is the file system goes to the buffer cache and says, these here blocks, force them in the disk now. I'll wait for them. Fsync says, I want this file going to the disk right now. To hell with BDFlush, I want them on the disk. And that used to actually work. Now it means you get them to the disk cache where they got it. But, okay. So there's this intermediate stage that deals with the block layer of abstraction. And one of the legacy issues that you'll see talked about in some textbooks, file systems used to use 1K block sizes. They're now mostly moved to 4K. Paging systems almost universally use 4K. One of the things that you want to do is memory map a file. If the block sizes are different, you get a mismatch at the end. The last block in the file may be shorter relative to the page. You know, if you have 5 1K blocks and if you have 4K pages, and I memory map the entire file, the question is, so what's in that trailing chunk of that last incomplete page? And since the file is actually a byte level of abstraction, it can happen regardless of your block size, but it can also happen with the block width. So in older Unix systems, you actually had two caches. You had the page cache and the block cache. And the issue is, because of the order of I/O, blocks could come into the block cache, you know, in funny random orders. And in order to map them as a page, you would actually have to migrate those blocks to the page cache, reorganize them as a page in the proper order before you could map them. And then when you went to write them back, you actually might have to pull them back into the block cache. And the only reason you had these two caches was to manage the impedance mismatch, the block size and the page size. The problem with having two caches is the next question is, well, how big should they be? And the answer is, I don't know. Depends what you're doing. The answer 5 minutes ago was different from the answer now. Moving the file system block size to the same as the page size is a lifesaver. There's a whole complex and buggy subsystem you get to remove. And it's mostly gone. But just a sort of bit of ancient history. All right. There's a punchline I'm trying to get to today. I was actually going to talk about block structure and file system today, but I'll do that tomorrow. But I want to plant a seed in an idea. There's something that we know about the demographics of files. Actuarial statistics. You know what actuarial statistics are? You know where the term comes from? Something none of you have probably given any great deal of thought to. It's called life insurance. That thing you read about in the papers, you're always seeing scams involving life insurance. Like people selling life insurance to people in the army, you know, that actually costs more than it's worth. There actually was a big scandal about that a couple of years ago. So actuarial statistics are the distribution curve of how long people live, or the term has come to more generally mean the distribution statistics of whatever events are of interest for purposes of your insurance. But the term originally comes in life insurance. So files have a distribution of expected lifespans. It's a very strange distribution. If I were to go around, we have actually a statistical universe here in this classroom. And if we were to go and graph your death dates, assuming that we knew them, not that I'm encouraging them to be sick, but let's imagine we knew them. What we would discover is that the graph would have a normal distribution and it would look like a completely conventional bell curve. Some of you are going to live a long time. Some of you, God forbid, may die next week. Most of you are going to live pretty much the same time as everybody else. In light of last week's events, this may be an unfortunate example, and I apologize. But if you graph the lifespan of files, you'll discover something very weird. Okay, so on this axis, so we're graphing the number of people versus the age of their death. Where this line in the middle is the average. So here, what we're going to graph is it's not quite that abrupt, but it's close. Young files die young. Old files live forever. Very few files make it from one group to the other. Think about why. Hey, you know, the vast majority of files that ever get written on your machine are temp files. They're working data of a program while it's running. And when the program ages, they're gone. And when the program rewrites the content, may grow the file, may shrink the file, actually not that often. I mean, how many times do you do an edit session that adds 4 kilobytes of new content to a text file? Well, actually, it adds on average 2 kilobytes. That's a lot of text. So, and by the way, under these circumstances, asking what's the average age of a file is a very weird question. I can give you a number. I don't know what that number means in practical terms. It's got no predictive value about the age of files. So it's meaningful but not motivated, if you see the distinction. Now, this says something weird. Second observation. We're never dealing with just one file at a time. We're always in this bind, well, we're rarely dealing with one file at a time. We're never dealing with two or three. It's sort of observed behavior in the wild. A given machine is all either working on one file at a time or it's working on some god-awful large number of files, right? There's never anything new. These young files, if you've got enough memory, they don't make it out of the buffer cache. That's why the best way to increase your battery life on a laptop is to add memory. You got a choice of doubling the processor speed or doubling the memory on a machine. You want the machine to go faster? Double the memory. Forget the processor. The processor is not where you're stuck. The disk drive is where you're stuck. Gaming is another deal, right? But I mean, for real use. So what's really going on is I have a whole bunch of overlapping files. And each of those files individually, right, is somewhere on this curve, and if I look at it as a statistical universe, it is this curve. So I've got a bunch of curves of this kind overlapping. Now this is something really interesting, because those files out at the right end that live a long time, they are going to disk. And if they're going to go to disk, and I'm going to have to read them again later, I care how fast I can read them, and therefore I care how they're laid out. The other observation, which I told you the other day, most file I/O is sequential. And even if I'm in random access, if I manage to get the file linearly organized on the drive, then even if I'm in random access, at least I can compute the seek offsets pretty in advance without going through a direction data. Now here's a really weird thing. In practice, if I look at the disk, I know we got it again. I've got a file system area and a swap area. And the temporary files are often going to go to the swap area. That swap area is small. Small, like just a few cylinders. Think about it. If you actually follow the instructions, and nobody does, and you configure a relay system with 4 gigabytes of swap, that's only 1% of that 500 gigabyte drive that you can get on the computer saying buy today. Right? As a fraction of the drive, it's a tiny fraction. It fits on just a few cylinders, like 2 or 3. All sinks across 2 or 3 cylinders are fast. You just don't have very far to go. So now I've got to ask, what's the distribution of accesses? And if I can make the case that most of my accesses go to the swap area, I'm going to win. 85% of my accesses are in the swap area, then some ridiculously high percentage of time, I'm only going to do a 2 or 3 cylinder sink max. And that's why random sinks don't tell you diddly. But what this means, and by the way, those temporary files, they fit here. Now, what this means is something very weird. Sorry, last observation, and then I will come back to this tomorrow. Look, once I place a file on the drive, I'm not going to move it. Its locality, once placed, does not change over time. As the drive gets heavily used, mostly full, it's harder and harder to place, so my locality will start to deteriorate. But whatever locality I get, it doesn't doesn't change. Locality determines whether I'm able to successfully linearize the file. I'm starting on this tomorrow. But because the swap area is all so tight, I'm much less concerned about linearizing the swap area. Hell, I can scan the entire swap area in one IO. I'll sort the blocks in memory if I have to. I don't really want to scan the entire swap area, but I've got a lot more freedom to place it. The interesting part is, if all of my I.O. is in the swap area, don't get linearization, but I get very high locality. The thing is, when it leaves the swap area, I fall out onto the other line, because then I have to actually put it back in the file system. If I were just to stay in the bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger swap area, then I would start, because the swap area size would grow, right? So this is, what I'm exploiting in this area is the fact that swap is small. The whole damn thing is small, so even if my file is scattered within it, I don't have very far to go. I'm going to come back to that point tomorrow, because it's going to give us a different way to look at structuring the file system than the one that we discussed. That's why I wanted to get it in the board. Do go take, get on Google and find out about configuring a laptop for low power. See you tomorrow.